Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What issues will dominate the Texas legislature in 2009? The 81st regular session of the Texas Senate and House of Representatives convenes next Tuesday, and lawmakers have been pre-filing legislation since November. Two veteran senators returning next week are here with us today to talk about the issues they expect to tackle over the next 5 months. Senator Florence Shapiro is a Republican who represents District 8 in Plano. Senator Royce West represents District 23 in Dallas. Welcome back to Think, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris.
So after the last session, there were as a $2 billion budget surplus. To what extent will that money play into the way you're able to start planning for 2010, given how much has changed in a year and a half?
Well, actually, the key to this whole thing is that there is a surplus, and there was probably about $11 billion for a variety of reasons, and the most of which, of course, is the issue of how high gasoline prices were for such a long time. The problem is that much of that money has been earmarked, and we have to use it for other things. Our business tax that we put in place, which funds our schools, is short. We don't know exactly how much yet because we haven't heard from the comptroller. She'll give us a report in the next week, but we're assuming it's somewhere about $3 to $4 billion. So that comes off the $11 billion. We have a very severe problem down in the Houston Galveston area from Hurricane Ike. We've got to certainly buttress that maybe to the tune of $2 to $3 billion. We have some issues, obviously, that we have to do with enrollment growth in schools. We have some issues dealing with the enrollment growth in our Medicaid, Medicare, CHIP program, those kinds of things. I think when the end of the day, I think we'll probably end up with a surplus, which we should be very proud of for Texas. There's a lot of states right now that are looking for money from the federal government, but I bet we don't have $2 to $3 billion.
And that's exactly right. I'm thinking it's going to probably be about $2 to $3 billion that we'll end up with. But again, we're in better shape than a lot of other states. You just got to think about the state of the economy overall, and we're looking at about a $1.2 trillion deficit, and we end up with a surplus. Texas ends up with a surplus of about $2 to $3 billion. But we had better make certain that we kind of button down the hatch a little bit, because I think that we still hadn't seen the full impact of what's going on around the country and the state of Texas yet.
And I agree with that. I also think that we're going to have to do what we did this year, and that is set some money aside, because no one has that magic crystal ball that's going to tell us where we're going to be in the next 2 years. And since we do our budgets on a biennium basis, we do them for a 2-year period, you know, we're really rolling the dice, so to speak, to figure out what the economy is going to look like in the next 2 years.
And Chris, and just let me say this, if we can assure the listening audience that we will get the best economists and get the best financial experts in the state of Texas to do the best forecast possible over the next 2 years to make certain that we discharge our fiduciary duty to come up with a balanced budget for the citizens of the state of Texas.
But the problem with that is we did the same thing as many states, of course, do. And something like, you know, last September comes, and no matter how well you prepare for it, it's not there.
And that's why you have to have that rainy day fund.
Exactly.
Is it your sense that the economy in the state of Texas is sort of at the very tip end of a whip, and we haven't felt things as strongly yet as other states, but our time is coming?
That's exactly right. I think our time is coming. I think that when you begin to see even though we've seen a little expansion in the state of Texas, I think we're going to begin to see more and more people, companies kind of downsizing in terms of employees.
And I'd like to be the optimist. I'll take the other view, and I'd say that the economy for the country, I think, is becoming a little more optimistic. And I'd like to say that maybe we've seen the worst. We've got to prepare for it. But I'd like to say that I think that hopefully we're starting to see a change. And I'd like to think that Texas has kind of insulated itself from a lot of that. We didn't see our housing market just go out the roof as far as increases. We haven't seen sales tax decreases like they've seen other places. I mean, I think we'll see some. I don't think we should be naive enough to think that everything's okay. It's not. But I also would like to not have that attitude that maybe, you know, the worst is still out there for us.
We need to make certain that we prepare for it. Now, for the worse. And that's why I'm saying we need to make certain we kind of button down our hatches to, and as we button those things down, we just got to kind of look forward, given that we prepare a budget 2 years in advance for what's coming down the road.
Right.
Texas State Senators Royce West and Florence Shapiro are my guests. We're talking about the 2009 Texas legislative session. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Is this a good year to increase funding for the Texas Enterprise Fund and for research and development, or is that something that financially we can't afford to do at this point?
Well, it always depends on what we talk about in far, as far as increase the fund. I think probably what we have to do is hold a lot of these funds constant, and that's probably two of them that probably need to just stay the way they are.
In terms of funding priorities, I don't know that I agree that we need to make certain that we maintain our funds, but I think we have some other issues that are a little bit more important at this point in time than increasing those funds.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about health care and children's health care specifically. Sure to be a major issue. What is the disadvantage, if there is any, or we should talk about the pros and cons of letting parents pay into CHIP even if they don't earn a sufficiently small amount to be included right now?
You know, the reality is that the state of Texas has left about $90 million on the table as it relates to CHIPs, and we need to do everything we can in order to use some of the general revenue that we have in order to pull down additional federal dollars. And so we need to open up CHIPs and allow parents to participate in order to increase the number of kids that we have insured in the state to be somewhat consistent and not always be number one in terms of the number uninsured in this number one, number two in terms of the number uninsured in this country.
I think the CHIP program is a very significant program. I think what we've got to do is make sure that it's being leveraged, as Senator West said, to the best of its ability. But CHIP is very specifically for children whose parents actually do have a job, but at the same time, they're not in a category that gives them the ability maybe to insure them. So they're the working poor is really the definition. And I think the issue of the working poor, nobody thinks that we shouldn't be doing that, but what we should be doing is making absolutely sure that there is a commitment on the part of the parent that this is something they want to do. I think the idea is helping them out, and I have no problem with that, but let's make sure that there is an investment that's made by the family as well.
You think it's reasonable to extend eligibility so once people qualify, they get to stay on for 12 months or longer?
Well, part of the problem that we had before was that they were staying on for 12 months or longer. When we changed it to every 6 months, it seemed like they were coming in and out of the program way too willy-nilly. And so this has been a dialogue and a debate that we've been having in the legislature now for quite some time. Well, we go back and forth on the decision of that.
I think it needs to be a 12-month certification because, again, when it was changed to six months, we ended up having a new way in order to certify people. And people ended up having to basically being dropped into black holes and not being able to go through the new quote-unquote system of certification in order to get that six-month certification. So I think it needs to be 12 months. And the reality is that when we get ready to look at spending general revenue, which is always a big issue, we need to look at trying to use dollars to leverage more money coming in from the federal government for this particular program.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, I'm really like someone to look at college tuition in the state schools even. It's gone up just astronomically, and it's hard to explain. I know that there's an oil endowment that underwrites some of that. Presumably that's been paying dividends, yet tuitions are just aside. I think it's $1,200 a semester in 85 when I graduated, and now it's, $5,000 to $7,000 a semester. That's a huge increase, not professor salaries. Well, where is that going?
Thanks for your call.
Well, of course, I'm the chairman of the education committee, so I'm happy to at least take a stab at that. I wish we knew where it was going. Unfortunately, there's no transparency. The way that the colleges and universities are funded by the state, and there are 35 public colleges and universities that are funded through our public system. But the way they're funded is actually two ways. One is with tuition and fees, and the other is with state dollars. In 2003, when the state actually controlled tuition and fees, we were had a $10 billion shortfall. And we decided at that point that it would be easier, maybe, and it would assist, maybe, for those institutions to now have the responsibility of their own tuition and fees.
Individually.
Individually. Created specifically for the needs of each of those institutions. We then thought that they would be very judicious in that decision. We do think that at the beginning they needed to beef it up a little bit because they were fairly low, but we never dreamed. I never dreamed, and I think I can speak for Senator West and, and myself, we never dreamed it was going to go at the rate that it is now. And I think you're going to find this session there's going to be a lot of bills for tuition freezes, for changes. I think we would not be smart, in my view, to actually go back to a re-regulated system. I think that would be very difficult to do because the state doesn't have that kind of money to put in. But I do think there have to be some caveats, and I think there has to be some caps on it. And I think we have to really take a strong look at transparency to be able to see where those dollars are going. The gentleman, Tom, that just called is absolutely right. Where is that money going?
So you don't think those caps or different kinds of measures to keep tuition at a certain level, those don't amount to re-regulation?
They are re-regulation, but they're not re-regulation in the way that you say the state will tell you how much you can charge.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I was not a proponent of deregulation. In fact, I voted against it. I've consistently appeared before the UT board and also the A&M board with my colleague, Republican Tommy Williams, asking them not to increase tuition. What's happened since deregulation vote by some of our colleagues, tuition and fees have gone up 53% since 2003. Thomas, yes, in many instances, too high for some middle-class kids in order to go to school. Now, what we did do during that time, and Senator Shapiro was part of the leadership on this, we indicated that if they decided, they being the institutions, decided to go up, they had to set aside about 20% of the increase aside in order to help, quote-unquote, lower-income students, but there was nothing basically given for the middle class. And so we need to really rethink exactly how we're going to fund higher education in order to make it more affordable for Texans. And, you know, and by the way, Chris, when you compare Texas with other states, it's still a bargain, if you will. But again, we need to make certain we kind of rethink it. I think that we need to begin looking more at allowing local units of government, specific geographical areas where those institutions are located, to contribute to the financial viability of those institutions. What do I mean? You take Texas Tech as an example. What would Lubbock be without Texas Tech? What would that economy be? That's one of the main economic engines of Lubbock itself. And so given the fact that the city of Lubbock and the surrounding area basically use that institution as an economic catalyst, they should have the ability, as an example, in order to set up a higher education district wherein they are able to support that institution with their tax dollars. Now, what that means is simply, do you increase taxes? Well, if they decide to do so, but I think we need to rethink how we allow tax dollars for special districts to be utilized. Should cities and other entities have the ability to turn around and look at using those dollars or those pennies in order to establish higher education districts that will help develop those institutions? That's an issue that I'm going to hopefully have an opportunity to debate this session.
Senator Royce West and Senator Florence Shapiro are my guests this afternoon. We're talking about the 2009 legislative session. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Senator Florence Shapiro and Senator Royce West. We are here talking about the 2009 Texas legislative session. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. As of October, I think, DPS now requires people who are not U.S. citizens to prove that they have legal residency in the United States before they can get a driver's license. But that is a rule as opposed to being a state law. How much do you expect that to be debated in this session?
A lot.
that was an easy answer.
I mean, the reality is you kind of hit the nail on the head. There's going to be a lot of issues, bills dealing with immigration. There'll be a lot.
Is that the state's job to deal with immigration?
I think it's a federal issue. You can't have a hodgepodge of different types of laws dealing with immigration issues in this country. So I think it's a federal issue that you have to deal with it.
And I agree it's a federal issue. I mean, we cannot do things that the federal government doesn't give us the ability to do. Obviously, we can secure our borders because we are in Texas, and Texas has a very porous border.
Right.
Obviously, we have laws on the books today that are not being enforced that we probably need to buttress and enforce. Obviously, there are things that will be debated and discussed during the legislative session that probably if a court of law came in and looked at it, it would be unconstitutional because we don't have the ability as a state to enact some of those things. But what you're discussing here, which is, of course, the DPS decision, is certainly something that we have the right to do. The question is that something that the legislature wants to do? And that was a big debate last session, and I think it will come back and be a big debate this session.
And I think that DPS kind of backed off implementation of that rule, too.
Waiting for the legislature
to act. Yeah.
But Royce and I, of course, differ on this pretty significantly, but I happen to believe that there is no reason for us not to know that someone is a citizen of this country. I mean, you have a driver's license, and a driver's license, pretty much says if you're here as a worker. It has a worker tag or worker connotation on it. If you're here as a visitor or a foreign student, it's got that on there. There's really nothing that should stop us from doing that. The question becomes, what is the purpose of that? And then that's where the dialogue begins.
And it's going to be a dialogue. I mean, and that kind of leads into the issue of voter ID. That's going to be a big issue during this legislative session, as it was last session. So we'll have some discussion concerning that also.
Yeah, another one has been specifically to make sure that people are U.S. citizens before they're allowed to vote. Has that been a documented issue in a lot of places that there are immigrants without legal status to vote that are casting ballots?
Based on the information I've seen, it hasn't been a big issue. I think it's and Florence and I disagree on this, and that's and we'll debate it. There has not been any significant documented issues concerning illegal immigrants voting in the state of Texas.
I will say this though. I mean, I do it myself. When I go to the polls to vote, many times I forget my voter registration card, and many times, in fact, I would say 99% of the time, I show my driver's license. I am not offended by that. I don't have a problem with that, and I don't really think that that's one of those things that we ought to have this big battle over, because a voter ID, if you don't have your card, you have to have some form of identification. Can't just say, well, I'm here to vote, but I don't have any identification. I happen to believe that a voter ID is exactly what it says, just telling people who you are, just like your voter registration form is, or your driver's license.
But again, it's not a big issue. There has been no documented, there's been no significant documentation that's a big issue in the state of Texas. And so, hopefully we won't spend a lot of legislative time on voter ID issues as opposed to trying to make certain that we balance the budget and put dollars where they need to be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Glenn in Sherman. Hi, Glenn.
I have a comment. Senator Shapiro said a while back that higher education budgets need to be transparent, and I find it unbelievable that she doesn't know that they are. They are a matter of public record. Anybody can go and see them. Most universities place them in their public libraries, and as a member of the Committee of Education, she ought to be able to get them herself. And it's really no secret what's happening in higher education budgets. It's happening to all of us. Is health care and energy costs are going up dramatically. And since the legislature refuses to fund higher education, it has to be done through tuition raises. So I mean, it's not very complicated. It's very plain. And if she wants to see it, she can go look at the budgets herself and see if that's what it is.
And please let me just mention to you that Senator West and I are both on the Finance Committee. And I must tell you that just because you have a line item that says you're spending X amount of dollars on electricity or whatever that item would be that you're talking about, we still cannot really fully understand where those dollars are going. And we are, I'm not going to speak for Senator West. I'll speak for myself. I am committed to making sure that we understand where that money is and why it's gone up at 50% in some schools, 53% at some schools. That has very little to do with, yes, electricity's gone up, and yes, the cost of energy has gone up, and yes, the cost of health care has gone up, but none of that has gone up 53%.
Do you have any sense that there's fraud or creative accounting going on?
I would never suggest that there was fraud. I don't believe that at all. I do believe that they're not being held accountable for where the money is being spent.
Look, guys, the reality is this. Is that we have got to put more money into higher education. I mean, think about the population right now. We have, 23 million people in the state of Texas? And by the year 2040, there's going to be over 40 million Texans. And the question is how do we educate them? How do we provide our institutions, higher education, the necessary resources in order to educate the future leaders of the state and also this country? And under the current scheme of financing our institutions, Glenn, we're not going to get there, given the increase in the various costs. So we're going to have to kind of have a discussion on exactly how we're going to finance it. We can't continue to allow our boards of regents to increase the tuition, but they're under pressure in order to do it, in order to rob Peter to pay Paul. And so we've got to look at another method of financing the institutions. And I'm saying, Glenn, that the best way to do that is to make certain that those specific geographical areas that benefit economically from those institutions have an opportunity based on a vote from the people to support those institutions so we will better enable them to meet the challenges of the future.
Since we're back on education, let's talk a little bit about the top 10% law, which basically guarantees admission to the top 10% of students from schools in the state of Texas.
You picked one that Royce and I...
Is it going to carry blows here?
No, not at all. Royce and I are very good friends, and we share a lot of the same thoughts about a lot of things. We are absolutely on completely opposite sides on the top 10%.
Let me finish outlining what it is so that people know what it is, and then I will let you both. We'll start with you, Senator Shapiro. Essentially, this allows the top 10% of graduating seniors, they are guaranteed admission to a state university of their choice. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. We'll start with you, Senator Shapiro. Tell me
81%, what you think. 81% of the incoming freshmen this year in 2008, 81% of the freshman class was out of the top 10%. If we continue along those lines, they're all wanting to go to the University of Texas at Austin. If we continue along those lines within the next 3 years, approximately 3 to 4 years, 100% of the entering freshman class will be in the top 10%. That gives no flexibility, no opportunity for any student in the state of Texas who is not in the top 10% to attend the University of Texas. That limits the type of student that you're actually getting. I sat down with the dean of music the other day at the University of Texas at Austin, and he was telling me that because of the top 10% rule, law, he is having limited number of scholarships for music students. They're not in the top 10%, so they're getting fewer and fewer opportunities for these students to come to the university. We have forced a dynamic that I don't think was the intent of this law 10 years ago.
What was the assumption that everybody would go all over the state?
The hope was they would go all over the state, but it was also because at that time there was a law that said that you couldn't use race as a criterion for coming into the universities. That has been changed. That is no longer the case. You can use race as one of the criterion. Now the case becomes not just the top 10% for racial decisions, but because rural school districts want to make sure that their kids are going to the University of Texas. So they're very excited about the law and want to keep it the way it is. The truth of the matter is, 12 years ago, before the law went into effect, 1% of the students were going to the university today out of rural schools. Today, it's still 1%. The difference, of course, is it's a larger quotient, but it's still 1%. It's not what people think it is. It does tie their hands. It does not give, as my friend Royce West has said it a million times, a holistic approach to a student and the student body. And I think it is very, very unfair. I have a bill that will divide it, at least split the baby in half, I guess, as you could say. And that is let 50% of the students come in under the top 10% and let the rest come in under other standards.
Senator West?
I think that if anyone looks at the top 10% law and look at its legacy over the past 10 years, you will see that those students that have been admitted under that policy, be they from humble means, be they from urban centers, suburbia, rural areas, that they have done quite well academically, that they have outperformed their non-top 10% cohort, that as one of the things we always talk about in the legislature, being on time, that they're on time more often than their non-top 10% cohort. When you begin to look at the diversity at the University of Texas at Austin, it looks more like the state of Texas now. And I don't have the data in front of me, you have more students that are from different high schools that are now being admitted at the University of Texas at Austin than you did prior to the implementation of top 10%. I think that bodes well for the state of Texas. Now, when you begin to look at the argument that's being made, I fail to believe that the University of Texas will not be able to recruit the best football players in the country, the best basketball players in the country, the best track stars in the country. So they'll find a way in order to get that done. And when we begin to talk about 81% of the entering class, I'm assuming the figure is correct. I don't know whether, is that of the accepted students or the enrolled students?
It's the enrolled students.
Okay. That's the enrolled students from Texas. That's not the entire freshman class. Now, do we need to continue to debate this issue? Yes, we do. And I'm willing to sit down and debate it, but I want to make certain that we keep the pressure on the University of Texas and other schools to continue to diversify and make certain that all kids within the state that are doing what we can see, say that exceptionally well in terms of their education, that they get the opportunity to attend not only Texas but other schools also.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey, great topic. Very, very happy that I caught it. I'm currently looking at the window on state government website with Susan Combs as the comptroller, and you know, the program began with, kind of this ceremonial pat on the back about the amount of money that might be left over in our budget as compared to the rest of the country, which is great, I guess, depending on who you speak to. But at the same time, some of the stats that are on this website, if the numbers are correct, which I'm assuming they are just astounding in terms of education. Our SAT scores are abysmal, 49 in verbal, 46 in math, and we're number 36 in the nation in high school graduation rates. I mean, we can talk until we're blue in the face about this idea of higher education, but when we stand where we do in terms of just high school, it's no wonder that the nation as a whole is falling so far behind from the rest of the world in terms of our math and our science. But just in terms of this state alone, I can tell you that as a citizen of this state, I would prefer to have the type of budget deficit that we might be facing in this nation if it meant that our children were being invested in from an educational standpoint, so that we might have the opportunity to continue to be competitive in the world. And that's my comment.
Tim, and let me respond to you. One of the things that over the last two or three years, I continue to go to the mountaintop and shout out to make certain that people understand it. We have a crisis as it relates to dropouts in this country. Back in 2006, the Schlotz Foundation indicated that 50% of African-American males and Latino males don't graduate from high school. And so when you sit up and say we have a 36% graduation rate, you're right. We've got to do something to make certain we keep kids, number one, keep kids in school, keep them engaged, and make certain that the curriculum is relevant to what we need to do in order to develop them in order to go on to a community college, a technical college, or to a university. So there is, yes, there is a lot of work done that needs to be done. Now, I was very, very dismayed, and I think that Florence can recall this. We had a joint hearing with the Education Committee, the House Education Committee, this spring when the Secretary of Education, a very dear friend of both of ours, came down Margaret Spellings, and basically testified before the committee. And I asked her, I thought it was a softball question. I lobbed this question out. I said, Madam Secretary, you know, are there any programs in this country that deal with, that have been successful at dealing with reducing the dropout rate for African-American males and Hispanic males? And she said, no. Now, mind you, this is the Secretary of Education, Tim, in the entire United States that said that. And when I said, and then I repeated the question, and the question was then reformed, basically saying, is there any program that's been in existence over 4 or 5 years that we could look at as a model in the state of Texas that would help us reduce the dropout rate for African-American males and Hispanic males? And she said no. And that's, Tim, in the entire country. So if that's happening in the country, yes, we do have a problem, and we need to make certain that we continue to shout at the top of the mountain this issue that's a crisis and that we do, in fact, address it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Patty asks that you talk about your positions on creating an independent bipartisan redistricting commission to be ready for the 2010 census.
The Republicans are in control, so I guess we...
Well, you know, this was a bill
and
that
the hardball
actually,
goes to Senator Shapiro.
That's right. That's right. That was not a softball. Thank you very much. We've discussed this before. We had this in Senator
Jeff
Wentworth brings this up every session. And certainly there are some pros and some cons that go along with it, obviously. I happen to think that that the process of redistricting has always been a very tenacious one. It probably brings out some of the worst in our two parties.
Trying to figure out where my vacation spot is.
That's right. But because we've done this before and they've been on vacation. They've actually gone to, that's right.
No.
Right.
We went to New Mexico.
They did go to New Mexico. But I think it's going to be an issue again. It's going to be a very difficult issue. I think a redistricting board certainly could answer some of the problems. But the truth of the matter is we're elected by the people, and the people demand that we do it and do it appropriately. So,
Senators Florence Shapiro and Royce West are with us. We're talking about the 81st session upcoming of the Texas Legislature. We'll return in just a moment, and you can get on the line to join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Senator Royce West of Dallas and Senator Florence Shapiro of Plano. Both of them will be in Austin on Tuesday for the start of the 81st regular session of the Texas Legislature. You can join us with your calls at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we will have a new Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss, and one of the things that he is championing is this idea that perhaps Texas should outlaw the ability for voters to hit a straight ticket ballot.
Say it ain't so, Joe. Say it ain't so.
Well, I think that's an interesting concept. Obviously, we've all been talking about that, both Republicans and Democrats, because it does lend itself to who's ever kind of in power at that time. I think this last go-round seemed to have really focused more on straight party line tickets voting. It'll be very interesting to see how people respond to that. And I think it'll be I don't think it'll be a Republican versus a Democrat issue. I think it'll be an issue that everybody will be talking about on both sides of the aisle.
It's going to be interesting. I don't know what position that the Republican Party is going to take on that issue.
I haven't seen it.
And I know that the Democratic Party hadn't taken an issue, but I would taken a position. But I would bet that the Democratic Party would be against the legislation itself, and probably the Republican Party also.
It'll be interesting to see.
It'll be interesting.
Yeah, I really don't know.
Do either one of you happen to know what percentage of voters tend to hit straight ticket?
I'm going to say probably on the Democratic side about 40%.
Oh wow, that's significant.
You're talking about the last election. I think the last election was the most significant on the Democrat side.
But I'm thinking that it's probably the same on the Republican side. About I know. I'm thinking the number's like 40% on Democrats and 40% on the Republican. The other 20% is going to be swing.
So there's nothing to preclude people from just going down the ballot and voting for all Republicans or all Libertarians or all Democrats.
Absolutely.
You know, I tell you, one of the issues, I'm over a task force for the Democratic Party that's going around the state to talk about the Texas two-step process. And some of the
explain what that is.
And the Texas two-step process basically is that we on the election night you go vote.
But only on the Democrat side. We don't do that on the Republican side.
But you still have your precinct convention. So.
Right. But yeah. But what you're describing is a Democrat.
It's a Democrat. You go and you vote, and then you come back to in your precinct convention. And both parties have precinct conventions. Right. But in the Democratic precinct convention, you sign in for your presidential preference, and delegates are allocated in part based on the number of people that sign in for that presidential preference.
We learned about that this past year.
Exactly.
Really, for the first time, many of us.
Exactly. And it was one of those, and this is aside, but it was one of those instances where there was, in fact, just an overwhelming number of people that participated in the primary. So we had huge issues associated with it. But one of the things that have come out during these particular hearings is that whether or not we should have a closed primary process.
Interesting.
Whether or not people would need to sign up as a Republican and vote in a Republican primary and not be able to come over to the Democratic primary or vice versa.
Yeah, a lot of states you have to register and
change
your registration.
Yeah, to be a Democrat or a Republican, right. Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know that I would agree to do that. I think it's a freedom that I have to decide where I want to go. I mean, I could vote in one of the other primaries and still end up voting for the other candidate in the general.
Right. You'd be able to do that. But in the primary, you'd have to vote for
you'd have to declare which you were.
Yeah, and then vote based on that. Hmm. So that's that came up several times throughout the state of Texas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Garland in Grand Prairie. Hi, Garland.
Yes, how are we doing now?
Great, thank you.
Yes, my question has to do with a national health care. I noticed that the new president is considering some form of national health care. America and Africa are the only industrialized nations without some form of universal health care. Where we at concern in our local legislator in considering that? Will it take 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? Are we considering at all?
Well, these senators work on the state level, but maybe we can talk about statewide health priorities for the next couple of years.
Well, I mean, the reality is that, yes, we are on a state level, and any initiative, a national initiative, obviously it must come from Congress. I can tell you this, talking to some of the people in the administration, obviously the economy is number one. But having a national health care network is a high priority of the next president of the United States. How do we control the runaway health care costs? You heard Thomas, I think, a few minutes ago, either it was Glenn, that talked about in terms of higher education some of the cost factors, increased cost factors, is that of health insurance. And it is, not only for our universities, but in industry and everything else. And so we will continue to try to find ways in order to reduce the cost of health care in this country and also the state.
Texas is about to have another shortage of prison beds. What do you think is the best way to deal with that?
Well, I think we have to evaluate those prison beds and decide if we're putting the appropriate people in those big walls. Too often, I think what we do is we throw people back into prison in a facility that probably needed to be utilized for a more hardened criminal instead of working towards some other issues. We are in a situation, I think, right now where we've got to reevaluate and evaluate who these people are, why they're in those prisons, what they're doing in those prisons, and make sure that this is just not some parolee who came out and had a traffic violation, which oftentimes we then send them back for a parole violation. We've got to be more judicious in our decision making. I don't believe we need to build any more prisons. I hope we won't build any more prisons, but I certainly think that if we continue, I think the newspaper the other day said that we have decreased our crime rate in Texas and certainly in the Dallas area over the last year. So hopefully we're making inroads in that arena, and people will start realizing that it's not one of those things you want to do because there are consequences.
You know, I think that a lot of people, when Craig Watkins, who's in the current DA here in Dallas County, ran for office and started saying that we need to be smart on crime, people were kind of laughing at him. Said smart on crime, what does that mean? During the last legislative session, Some of my colleagues laughed at that also. But guess what? By the end of the session, people start talking about we need to be smart on crime. And so when we begin to look at building new facilities, we need to make certain that, as Senator Shapiro just mentioned, that we evaluate exactly who's in those beds and whether or not they need to be in there. We need to be smart on crime in the state of Texas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email from Jim who says, I would like to encourage additional funding for the Texas State Park System. Other states, including traditionally poorer ones, such as Arkansas and Kentucky, have shown that parks can provide significant revenue from tourism and generate income from private businesses in areas near parks from tourism. Are either of you aware of anything filed that would put more money into the parks?
We did that last session. We put a significant amount of money into the parks last session. We should be seeing reaping the benefits of that.
This time around, yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to, we will go next to John in Denton. Hi, John.
Yes.
Hi, John. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is John Paul Eddy, and thank you for covering this program. I think some very excellent comments have been made by our legislators. I'm very concerned about the fact that since December 2007, the experts, of course, they just admitted it recently, said we're in a recession. And yet, during that time, some of our higher education administrators at our public universities got huge salary increases, actually some 2 years in a row, while faculty and other higher education personnel received no cost of living increases. So I'd like to see the legislators have more insight and oversight on the higher education faculty and administrator salary situations, because without them we can't run our universities. I haven't heard anything addressed on this program so far. I followed you. I appreciate it very much. And also, I appreciated the comments that our national education department has neglected our Latino and our Hispanic, and may I add, because I'm part American Indian, Native American students. So please answer this oversight on salary increases, because it sets up very bad morale situations between the faculty and the administrators in this these universities.
Thanks.
And then they come out and ask for more money, and they're not willing to sacrifice themselves. A lot of us also have gone down.
I really appreciate your call, and we do have your point, and I want to make sure that we have a chance to have them answer you. So thank you very much.
There's one other point.
All right, John, I've got to move on, but we will make sure that we get a response for you. Thank you so much.
I think that's a good example of the problems that we have, obviously, because we don't have oversight, and that's okay. But the responsibility is with the Board of Regents. That's who really is there. That's almost like local control, as we talk about in public education, and certainly needs to be addressed by their local Board of Regents. Those people are the ones that agree to the salary hikes. Those people are the ones that agree to the faculty, and that's certainly not something that I think the state ought to be micromanaging.
Yeah, I agree.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Does Texas need universally available pre-kindergarten?
I would say yes.
And I would say no. We currently have pre-K available to any child who is comes under the federal guidelines, which of course is a low income student. They're available to every student 3 years and older. I just don't believe that universal. First of all, it's enormously expensive. I think what I'd like to see, of course, is that those children that are in preschool, that they get a little bit better education, that they actually get some more learning tools and skills and reading skills and those little things that a three-year-old really needs if they're going to come out of a situation that's less than desirable by the time you get to kindergarten.
Now, you asked the question, do we need it? I'd say, yes, we do. And can we afford it? No, we can't. Now, why would we need it? Because, again, just as one of the gentlemen just mentioned a few moments ago, we have a 36% graduation rate. And I'm taking that figure from what he got off of the website. in order to make certain, let me back, put a pin in it for 1 second. When George Bush was governor of the state of Texas, he had an initiative basically saying that if you couldn't read by the third grade, we wanted to make certain that you didn't go forward, because if you can't read, you can't succeed. Initially, I was just totally opposed to that, and we put in some triggers to make certain that parents had input in that particular process. We know that if kids aren't developed by the time they get to the third grade, then they're going to end up being left behind in many instances. And so, therefore, we need to make certain that we do everything we can from the very beginning in order to give those kids a jump start. And I think universal kindergarten would in fact, do that. Now, can we afford it? No, we can't. But do we need it? Yes, we do.
Can we afford to change the requirements so that public pre-kindergarten teachers, for those that can get it, are required to have a degree? Would that make a difference?
Ask the question again.
I believe Head Start teachers are not required to have a college degree.
That's correct.
That is correct.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're hitting on a very important point. They're not babysitters. They shouldn't be babysitters. It should be more than that. But three-year-olds are still babies. They're still children. And my thought is that if you start putting them into school at 3 years old, there's no valid statistic, and I've been looking at this, that says that a pre-K student, three-year-old, that actually goes to school does better and graduates. I went to a school the other day, not long ago, that said that we're looking for that evidence. We're looking. There's lots and lots of anecdotal information. There's very little data that makes the case for this. So if, in fact, that would make the case, I would be happy to look at it, but we haven't seen it yet.
Now, based on, and I think it's anecdotal also, that kids that are in pre-kindergarten programs have a more extensive vocabulary than those that are not in those programs. So that tells you something in terms of their preparation for elementary school.
But they drop off. That's the problem. By the eighth grade, they drop off. We haven't found a statistic one that says that they are not dropping out of school at the same rate.
Well, I mean, the reality is that the statistics show that basically from about like the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, we have a dropout problem.
But even if they're in pre-K, they're dropping out.
Well, I mean, and maybe I hadn't seen those statistics, yeah. And I look forward to looking for them. But the reality is that. I still believe intuitively that kids that are involved in those types of programs will be better prepared in order to deal with the rigor of the curriculum that they have to face in order to get through school.
In the seconds that we have left, I'm curious about the preparation that each of you do before you're about to head down to Austin for what must be the most intense 5 months of every couple of years. How different are the day-to-day rhythms of your life when the legislature is in session?
Completely different.
Yeah.
We are focused 100%
right.
on the legislature. You really have to be able to take yourself out of whatever environment you're in, back at home, family, business, whatever it is, and really insert yourself into a whole different environment. And it is a little bit easier at the beginning because you're just getting started. So the first few weeks, it just gives you a little time. But by the time you hit the last couple of months, it's intense.
We have a saying in our office, don't sweat it, you have all night.
Thank you so much to Senator Royce West and Senator Florence Shapiro, who have been here. They will be starting the 81st session of the Texas Legislature next Tuesday. It's been great to have both of you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.